Hey, welcome to Second Wind Women. I am here today with Katrine Horn. Katrine is an international life coach and TEDx speaker, and she helps ambitious women step out of autopilot and into lives and leadership that feel fully aligned. She shows up with courage and curiosity, whether having tea with a friend or on a TEDx stage, guiding clients to make decisions from confidence, not fear, and live on the edge of what's possible. Welcome, Katrine.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's a joy meeting you again.
Thank you. It's lovely to have you here. Let's talk a little bit about your kind of your career path, because you started out like just from the get-go choosing a very unique path, right? Yeah.
I would agree. It was completely crazy. And it really defined me because I wanted to play the harp when I was very little. It's still sitting over here in the corner.
Oh, amazing.
So I got that idea because my parents took me to see Swan Lake, which is a classical ballet. And so you see all the pretty ballerinas on the stage, and it was a dream. And then I heard the harp. And I'd never heard the harp before. And I just thought, I want that. I want that. And that was all I could think about. So I kept talking about it to my parents. And when I was 11, they agreed I could play the harp and found me a teacher. So that really set me off in life because I thought, people are telling me I can't be an interpreter. I wanted to be an interpreter. I couldn't be an architect. And if I became an architect, I would be bored out of my mind because I'd be designing schools, and I didn't like school, and elderly people's homes. So that just wasn't very fun. So I thought, why not play the harp professionally and why not go and emigrate to London? So let me get out of here and see some of the big world.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Denmark.
Okay.
And that just sort of got me thinking, well, people will always tell me I can't do what I want to do, but I really don't need to listen to them, right? I can just go ahead and do whatever my fancy tells me to do. And that has always worked out in my life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's amazing because, you know, we were forced to see Swan Lake many times when I was young. And it was always... Everybody was always like, I want to be a ballerina. I want to be a dancer. I want the costumes. I've never heard of anybody before like fixating on a particular instrument.
Yeah, it was magical. It really was magical. And I can't really justify it other than that it was like a pull on my heartstrings.
I get it. Yeah. How uncommon is it for... So I remember when I was young, I had a Sicilian uncle and we went to see him and he would say to me, Karen, you should learn to play the French horn. And I said, why, Uncle Gennaro? Why should I learn to play the French horn? He said, because nobody plays the French horn. I found out later because it's really hard. But so how unusual is it to be a professional harp player?
Well, can you name any?
None.
No, so it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, most of us can think of a pianist. Some of us can think of somebody who plays the violin or perhaps a saxophone if you're into jazz or depending on what kind of music you like. But very few people can name one single harpist that they know. So it's very unusual. And... I think, well, I've got a whole theory about that, but...
Yeah, let's hear it.
Oh, yeah, so stop me when you've had enough. So the harp, as we know it today, was really only developed in 1820. So that was at a time where they were starting to develop the big concert halls and they sort of changed all the instruments to be a lot louder so that you could hear them in a concert hall. Because before that, it would be in somebody's private chateau where people would be sitting listening to like Haydn and Mozart. But now people were going out into public places, into public concert halls, listening to all that big music from Brahms and Beethoven and all these famous, famous people. And the poor little harp was just classified as a woman's instrument. So it stayed in the home. It never went public.
Oh,
it just stayed at home and was played by little ladies. And it was never taken seriously. And no serious composer ever composed anything for the harp, because it was just like a feminine instrument. And I'm a feminist, so I'm not going to excuse myself for saying that. But it just wasn't being taken seriously by society and composers who wanted to be somebody. It was just like, yeah, a sort of secondary instrument for salons, for
like the auto harp today. You know what auto harp is?
No, I don't.
It's basically like a flat harp. So like a harp on a box, and it has these little things that you can move to make chords. So it's really easy to play, but like you see somebody like a busker playing it, but you would never go to something where somebody played an auto harp.
Wow, that's an excellent comparison. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
So it stayed a woman's instrument, and it's still finding it very difficult to get out in the big world, I find.
When you were talking just now, when you were talking about music becoming big in these concert halls and such, I was thinking about the first time I ever went to an opera in person, because I'd seen it on videos and stuff. But the first time I ever went to an opera, I was like, this is transcendent. There's like a full orchestra, you know, 20 people singing perfectly at the top of their lungs. It was like dopamine blast. And, you know, like a harp might get lost in all of that because it is a thinner, like more delicate sound in general, if you're not doing really low notes. Yeah.
It really is. Nothing like the French horn. But I put on a play a long time ago about women in history, really. Women who made a difference. Who made a difference for the generations after them. And I looked into women composers.
Oh.
As you know, they're not that many, really.
No.
They really aren't that many. And why is that? So I started reading Virginia Woolf and finding out, I don't know whether you know, she wrote a book called A Room of Your Own, and it's about how she walked through the halls of Oxford. Oxford is a university in the UK, and she noticed that there were no women there. It was all made for men. And she posited that it's so difficult for women to get started being successes or being artists, because nobody's gone before them. No woman has gone before them. And I really believe that we have been held back by that. And some women have been very courageous and gone before us. And so thank you to all those ladies. Thank you so much.
I didn't know you were a playwright. That's cool. That's cool. Yeah, actually, I heard a woman actually on, I think it was on TikTok or something yesterday. And she was talking about how there was this guy who was being interviewed in a format very much like this. And he was saying, oh, you know, I really love being a father. And, you know, now I'm, you know, starting my own company. And I moved to I'm going to say London because I said London before. I moved to London and I lived in a flat with like 10 guys and we're all doing this thing and blah, 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 blah. And the woman was like, where's your kid? Where's your kid the whole time? Because you have a support staff, which is the mother of the kid, whether you're together or not, right? If the kid's not with you, you have a support staff taking care of your kid. And I think that is just the, you know, I have a strong feminist bent too, as you can tell. But when you think about that, and so like the historically, the women who did become composers or writers or something like that, I mean, look at Emily Dickinson, right? Single her whole life, no children, no family, right? For her to have, so she could take the responsibility of following her muse.
Charlotte Bronte, Jane Austen, all the anonymous authors of the Renaissance who couldn't write their names on their compositions because they were women and it was unacceptable.
Yeah, it's tragic, but it does shine a light on, you know, regardless of how much contention there is between the sexes and genders today, it shows how much freedom we have now.
Yeah, so let's enjoy it, right?
Yeah. Lean in. Lean in, ladies.
Exactly.
So tell me a little bit about your professional progression then. And I understand you've gotten into kind of like rehabbing estates.
Yeah. You could say that, yeah. Why wouldn't I? So I started out as a harpist, and that was my career for about 16 years. I toured around Europe. I moved to Paris and kept playing the harp all over the place. And that was fun for a while, but I really fancied living in one of those gorgeous sort of estates in the south of France, one of those manor houses. And I just thought...
Who wouldn't? Yeah.
Who wouldn't? Yeah. And I persuaded my husband that we wanted to do that. So we did. We found this house very serendipitously and we moved in. It was a ruin, right?
Really?
It was a ruin. There was only the walls and the roof. So we had to change all the windows, all the floors, everything.
Did you live in it while you were doing that?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I don't need to do that again because I've already done it. So.
How long did it take you?
Well, to go through all the rooms, it took us 3 years. But,
and how many rooms were there? About? I don't need to say.
So about 10 rooms in 3 years. But then we decided, look, there's really a second floor we need to open up. So we've got what we call the ground floor in the UK, but for you in the States, it's the first floor. So we've got a second floor, and that's what we did up over 3 years. And then we added a third floor.
Oh, that wasn't there before.
Well, it was, but it was sort of, it wasn't a hayloft, but it was a sort of storage space with the most gorgeous carpentry. But nobody saw it because we didn't really store very much up there.
Yeah.
So we took all of that out and opened up some windows and made it into a concert hall, really. So we've got two pianos up there.
Are there pictures online? Can people see pictures of this?
I don't know. Mm. I don't think there are. No.
I'm dying to see what the top floor looks like now.
Yeah. Well, you must come and visit.
Okay. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, that's only that. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you spent 3 years. Basically, I imagine this took over your whole life.
I never was in the position where I didn't have to work to make a living. Like I had to bring in money somehow. So I decided I could be a teacher because teachers have got long holidays or vacations, right? So I became a teacher. And I was put in front of a room full of savage children. Coming from classical music, I thought everybody listened to Brahms and read Jane Austen, right? But some of these children had parents who worked reality television. And, like, I didn't know it existed. Like, I'd never had a television. So it was just like, wow, there's a whole different society going on here that I was completely unaware of. So they educated me, those little kiddos, for a number.
How old were they? How old were you?
They started at 11 and it went up to 16. So it's
they really did educate you then. Yeah.
Yeah, they did. Because what they taught me was that I couldn't be fake and I couldn't play a role. Like I was used to being on stage and playing roles.
Yeah.
But that just didn't work in the classroom because they wanted the real me. But I didn't know who that was. And so I thought I had to play the role of teacher, and that just didn't work. And they taught me that getting rid of all my masks, getting rid of all the fakeness, becoming real, vulnerably so, I mean, not oversharing, but being willing to be myself in front of them, that was the only thing that they would accept. And so they really taught me that I was acceptable as I am. So that was a great gift. So that was what I was doing as I was doing at my house.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I feel like a lot of people get that same experience through parenting that you got through teaching, you know, where you try to be like, well, the proper parent thing to do is go to your room, you know? And so many times I caught myself doing that with my daughter. I'm like, you're grounded. And then I'm like, oh, hold on. I don't think this is actually going to work. But let's back up here and talk.
Rewind. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So you're still in that house now?
Yes.
Okay. And so you moved on from working with children to you do some kind of career development now?
Like I'm just a life coach.
Okay. Don't say just.
Well, it is just because many people call themselves executive coaches and all of that. I don't really know what that means because it's all about the person, isn't it? So yeah. It's all about developing who you are, I believe. And I call myself a life coach because I haven't specialized in relationships or in work or in something like that. I think we function holistically. Mm-hmm. So I can't be one person when I go to work and another person when I come home. One right. person with this friend, another person with that friend. It's like I have to be me all over the place. And I think that is really the only way we can feel good about ourselves is when we don't have to modify who we are to right. fit into an environment. So that's why I call myself a life coach. And I really enjoy that.
You know, I would argue that it's impossible for you to be someone who you are not. I would argue that even though you think you're doing really good at wearing masks and following rules that don't align with you, you're not actually doing that good at it.
I know. I was doing some journaling this morning and I was looking into how it is that I know how to fit in. I know how to fit in the UK on stage. I know how to fit in a classroom. I know how to fit in France. I know how to fit in. But it's not because I know how to that I have to.
Right, right.
And now I'm choosing not to fit in because I don't fit in everywhere.
It's impossible. Thank God it is impossible to fit in everywhere because there's so many, you know, variations of experience that we have the opportunity to live, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But I spent much of my time trying to fit in. Like when I was younger, it was about, oh, I have to speak English the way the English speak. And then I have to speak French the way the French speak. And then I have to do this the way other people do it. And it all gets really, really muddled and it gets to be really tiring. And so when I started to become more of myself, it was sort of more of an uncovering and allowing myself to like things that weren't really mainstream. Like my core value now is beauty. And what does that even mean? And are you allowed to have a core value called beauty? Is that
what
even
is that? I'm interested to know. What does it mean? What does that mean to you?
It means that I am allowed to always choose beauty over practicality, over convenience, over anything. It's just like, I know, oh, this is something I find beautiful. You might not, but I do. And I'm allowed to always choose that. I'm allowed to not settle for anything that is not beautiful. So I'm allowed to drink my water from this glass, right? I'm allowed to have fancy flowers wherever I like. I'm allowed to choose only the best, the environment that supports me at my best. Like I can have chandeliers in the bathroom if I so like. It's not a problem. I can have everything I find beautiful.
Love that. That is an amazing life coach lesson that I think people need to hear again and again and again, because there's this trivialization of beauty.
Yeah. But when you think about it, when you sit back and when you're not watching a screen, which we might be doing a little bit too much, some of us, if you're just looking around where you are, do you find it beautiful? Is it supporting you? And I think we go onto our screens because we really don't enjoy our environment. Like we are looking to escape it in some ways and forms. And so why not work with your environment so that I can spend my time sitting on my sofa enjoying looking out of the window or enjoying my curtains or enjoying just a whole atmosphere that I've built for myself. And I know that when I support myself I get to be at my best. Like, I get to talk to you today, being fully present here, loving everything about it. Like, I'm not halfway somewhere else. I'm right here, and that's where I want to be. It's like, well, what really supports you? I invite my clients to think about, well, what would support me? And is there anything I need to change in my environment, inside or outside? And if so, let me go about doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. You're reminding me of the Buddhist definition of boredom. Because so oftentimes we get on, you know, you'll be like, oh, I'm bored. I'm going to read a book. This book is boring. This event is boring. But boredom really just means aggression towards where you are and towards your experience.
I love that. I really love that, because I journaled on boredom too this morning. So that's really
interesting. Oh, you did?
Yes, because I think that, like, when I get busy, you know, taking action out in the real world, I'm doing that so that I'm not bored. But I got that the wrong way round, right? I don't need to take any action to fight off boredom. I can sit here, do nothing, and be perfectly entertained.
Yeah. Yeah. Entertained. Yeah. Because if you've set up your atmosphere like you have as a reflection of what pleases you, I'm not going to get very, like, you know, this Abraham Hicks here or anything, but then it's reflecting back and forth. Right. And I think the problem is with boredom and the aggression that you feel towards your reality is you're like, that's not how I feel inside. That, you know, like, bringing those into alignment seems really, what's that called? Like, when something supports each other, symbiotic.
Yes, I know. And what's the other word that makes it into even more? Is that also symbiotic? Like,
go ahead.
No, I can't think of the word, but it's like you bring this with that, and the two together are not just the sum of them, they're even more.
I would say gestalt. Is probably the word you're looking for,
okay.
That's super niche.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Gestalt is a type of psychotherapy, which is basically the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Right.
That's the one.
Yeah. So gestalt is the word you're looking for.
Well, thank you. I should make a note of that.
Oh my goodness. So tell us how do you work with people, and how do you kind of, you know, enable people to find this alignment in their own experience?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there are many ways of finding it, because fortunately we're all different. So it starts with you becoming really clear on the life experience you want. And so that can mean discarding some of the things you've got in your life and saying, I didn't actually choose them. I just sort of fell into them by happenstance. Like, it's not a conscious choice of mine, and it's not really bringing me any pleasure. So maybe I don't need to tag it along anymore. I can get rid of it. And that can be more or less difficult, because if it's a person, well, then it could pose a few problems. But really, we have to get clear on what we want to enjoy in life and who we want to be. And I think the two are completely linked. So that's really where we dive in. And how we do that really depends on the person and how spiritually open they are willing to be, how much they want to keep dragging their past into their present and projecting it onto their future, how much they are identifying with their intellectual brain, and how willing they are to let go of some of that.
I love it. Dragging your past along into your future. That's very vivid.
Well, we do that, don't we? I mean, we do that because it feels safer. Because if we could be anything tomorrow, that feels really scary, doesn't it?
It can.
It's much better to take all this evidence from the past of how I'm limited, so that when I look into the future, I can predict it more easily.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people define themselves by, I mean, I know for me also, I define myself by my past experiences. Somebody says, who are you? You say, well, this is where I went to school. I have kids, blah, blah, blah. I live in this place. I do these things. It's interesting how you could use that either as I guess your point is curation, right?
It completely is, yes.
Yeah.
And it's really deciding, because I think people identify with who they are. And what if that was just completely random? What if who you believe you are is just one of the 1,000 million possibilities that there exist? And if you got really curious about it and you could actually decide who you want to be, then who would you want to be?
That's cool. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't think they have that power.
Well, we do, really, if we're willing to let go of the past. But if we want to refer to the past all the time, well, then we have to take that into account. But when you look at it, that you were born somewhere randomly, of course, some people believe that you chose where you were born and all of that. That really doesn't matter, whatever your beliefs are. You were born somewhere, and then you went through life rather randomly because you went to a school that you didn't choose. Your parents chose for you, or they chose it perhaps out of convenience, not conviction. And you ended up muddling your way through school, and maybe you went on to study, maybe you went out to work. And all of that might have been completely without your deep intention focus where you wanted to go. And from there on, what you might end up with at 45 is something that you didn't choose at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And why wouldn't we want to change that?
Yeah, of course. Of course. And I mean, that's the point of this whole podcast, is that a ton of people want to change that. A ton of people. And isn't it sad that it takes until we're 45 that we go, oh, hey, I have a little bit of, you know, I have more than a little autonomy here.
Exactly. Exactly. We have more than a little autonomy because we are so powerful. And I think we've also got, if we want to expand, like if we want to use this life for all there is, well, then we have to allow ourselves to become that more we've been holding back from. And if we want more out of life, it doesn't mean that we are ungrateful. It doesn't mean that what we've got is not good. Like, my life is good. I've got my dream man. I've got my dream house, got my dream business. I mean, life is good. And I want even more. And that's allowed. Did you know that? It's allowed. Yeah. We can have more. So my more is living in a chateau. Not to say that this is not good enough, but there's more, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I have to become the woman who lives in a chateau and who curates, as you say, that experience, and who's the person who can allow other people to come and experience the beauty of it with her. And I think that's so good to know. It's as if second wind women, there could be eighth wind women too. Like, we are always allowed to evolve, and it's never too late.
Yeah, yeah. It's such an important lesson. And I think it's kind of my crusade, particularly with the podcast, you know, because I feel like a lot of people, again, women particularly, because, you know, in Western culture, it's very much built up that the man is the main character and the woman is the supporting role. Even if you're single, right? You're like, oh, I want to be in the executive. I want to make it to CEO. Maybe you're going to have a kid. We don't want to really do that. But it's such a, I feel like there's such a internal restriction for most people. And you really have to get to, like, I think I told you when we talked before we did this interview, really the whole point is like when you reach your, what I call your fuck it point, where you're like, I'm at a breaking point. I've got to do something different because this is not me. And like you were talking about, like pretending to fit into different situations and never really authentically feeling like yourself, therefore devaluing what that is.
Completely. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
So crazy.
Yeah.
So crazy.
Crazy. So what I help my clients see is that they are unique. They are so unique. And we all need to experience that uniqueness. And that is really how we make the world a better place. It's by being ourselves and shining our lights in whatever shape or form we happen to want to do that, because there is no right and there is no wrong. So, of course, you can be a full-time mother, right, and shine your light like that. That is all good. Great. No need to be upset, but we don't have to.
Right, right.
Everything else is possible too. And I love how you stress that we are, as women, we're often playing the supporting role, aren't we, that we embrace because, oh, it feels so good when somebody else is in charge and they've got the responsibility and then we get to complain and that feels really good. And what would it be like if I took full responsibility of all my outcomes, actually? Wow. Would I want to do that? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I think that exactly what you're saying is there's a movement in the United States right now. Hopefully it's on the decline. At last I heard it was on the upcline. It was on the increase of this, what they call trad wives, which are these young 25, 30 year old women who are like, I just want to stay at home and bake bread and blah, blah, blah. And I really think that you have hit like the core thing there, which is that I don't want the responsibility. I'm going to stay at home. I mean, and again, like if that was your dream and you love it, great. But if you're doing that because you're scared of stepping out in different ways, then that's just hurting yourself.
Yeah, I think it's also that we can get so overwhelmed with the job market or so overwhelmed with the conflicts out in the world, so overwhelmed with a lot of things that we take refuge in something where we're not really as empowered because we are giving the responsibility over to somebody else or a structure or something else. And, well, that can feel comfortable for a while, but let's just recognize that it is for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just human nature. I mean, if you look at, I'm not a big history buff, but if you look at the history of almost anything, it's like swing towards, you know, everything is rule-based and very intense and you must do it the right way all the way over to we're having orgies. You know, it always goes back and forth, you know, because the right answer is in the middle, but it moves so much and people always want to be like, ah, there's got to be something else. There's got to be a right answer when really they should.
Exactly.
Yeah. For people who are listening, I pointed to myself and then I made an outward motion, whatever that meant.
Yeah. Well, the answers are always on the inside.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's kind of what that's a very good explanation of what you're talking about with surrounding yourself with beauty, right?
It took me a long time to admit that it was valuable because when I was a young student, I lived in the most dreadful surroundings. It was so ugly. You could hardly imagine it. But try to imagine London in the 1980s with a lot of carpets in the flats, a lot of sofas with faded flowers on them and unmatching wallpaper. And it was just always so, so ugly. And I thought,
dingy, dirty carpets that were like yellow brown and like this.
Yeah.
Deep. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I was so proud because I could live with it. Oh, look, I'm living with it. Like I'm abstracting, I'm just not noticing, but I'm living with it. Look at me, I'm so good. Right. But really what I was doing was just denying that my desire is for beauty and why I try to force myself into a situation that I don't find beautiful, right? Why be proud of having adapted myself completely away from who I am? Why be proud of that, right?
Because it took effort.
Yeah. Right. Oh, and effort is so valuable, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it could be misused like anything. It's a tool, but I could see how you could believe that it had value because it took effort, even though it was misaligned.
And it was also that, well, you can't say you want beauty. I mean, what does that even mean? I mean, that is just not on, right? That's not serious enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. People want freedom. They want They weren't independence. They weren't things like that.
Right.
And beauty, I mean, who wants that? Who cares, right? That can't be something.
Very much like the harp. It's been trivialized, right? Mm. And it seemed to be too delicate and too, you know, doesn't stand up to what we need in reality.
Yeah. It's not forceful enough.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, when I see your background now, you have this like, you know, pale, but like vibrant blue and these portraits and the harp and the flowers. And it's very, it's just relaxing to look at. It feels, it's like they say that the reason people like birdsong is that it signals safety, right? Because there's no predators coming if the birds are all singing. And the same with if you're creating a beautiful atmosphere, you're settled. You want to stay there for a minute. It feels good, you know? Yeah,
and you can relax.
Yeah. I've never met anybody who said that their core value is beauty. It's always been like integrity, honesty, yeah. Value, you know. I think that's incredible. Yeah.
But we get to choose, don't we?
Yeah, we do get to choose. So how can people work with you, Katrien?
They can just reach out to me on email, via my website, or on social media, and I shall get back to them.
Amazing. Amazing. It's been so great to talk with you. Is there anything else that we need to address that we didn't really talk about that you can think of?
Well, I think that I want to just remind everybody, including myself, that we only live once. So why not make the best of it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this, I don't want to be tacky, but this life is a gift. I'm not going to say that. But it is. It is.
When I was really young and I was so afraid to emigrate because I had to leave my home, right, and move to a country where I didn't understand what people said. And I did all that on my own. It was hugely scary. But I told myself, well, when you're going to die, will you regret having done it or regret not having done it? And really, I just thought, well, do you know what? I don't want to die with a lot of regrets. And that's really always been like my baseline. Like, will I regret doing this or will I regret more not having attempted it, even if it's going to be a massive big failure? Like, what do I choose, really? And it might be difficult, you know what, but we can grow through it. We really can. And we were made to live. Like, we were designed to live. We were designed to feel all of our emotions. We were designed to have good experiences, not so good experiences, dreadful experiences, and come through all of it with flying colors.
How old were you when you immigrated?
18.
Oh, by yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, with your harp in tow?
No, that was sent on after me.
Okay.
Because I had to find a place to live, first of all, and, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents were very brave or unaware. I don't know, but.
It sounds like they loved you a lot to buy you a harp when you were 11.
I didn't get my harp till I was 16.
Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't get I can't get all the ages right. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for talking with us today. I really hope that people reach out to you because I love your message.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. I love the whole concept of empowering people to believe that they can actually start right over again. Like, they can do anything they like. They can have that second wind, right? And it's really about getting that wind into your sails. Get the direction and start going. And you are showing us the way. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Ta-da! Oh, it didn't...